You're tuned into People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
How do you defy this? You're going to have to take some big political risks because the force is against you. They only want poor kids to be trained in things that are immediately of utilitarian value to the economy, and they mean the lower levels of the economy.
People's Tribune Radio provides a source of revolutionary audio programming to people interested in changing society. It is produced in association with the newspaper People's Tribune, the bilingual magazine Tribuno del Pueblo, and Speakers for a New America. Today we receive a lesson in U.S. public education. We learn why schools are more segregated now than before the 60s, who has access to quality education and educational facilities in the U.S., and why is education of the poor so disregarded. Today's program contains excerpts of a talk given by an extraordinary teacher and advocate for education and social justice. Jonathan Kozel travels the country sharing his 30-plus years teaching experience and listening to other teachers, students, and parents. Kozel spoke at a meeting of school teachers in Oakland, California, in support of their efforts for a contract that protects the quality of public education as well as their health benefits.
Segregation of Black and Latino children, if you don't know this, I'm sorry I have to tell you this, has returned with a vengeance to public schools across America. I've just spent 5 years visiting public schools in 11 states across the nation. If you took a photo of the typical inner city classroom that I visit, a color photo, it would look exactly like a photo taken in a class in Mississippi in 1935, 1940, I'm telling you. The percentage of Black kids who now attend deeply segregated schools is at its highest level since 1968, since Dr. King died. The Supreme Court, the Rehnquist Court, basically ripped the guts out of Brown over the past 15 years. The four most segregated states for both Black and Latino kids are New York, that's the most segregated state in America, Michigan, Illinois, and California. California is fourth in the nation. Particular shame that California also, but essentially one of the wealthiest states in America, spends at the level of Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. You know, it's not just that they're segregated, you know, racially and economically, but that it's also as though we've developed like an apartheid curriculum for these kids. And you know, while the children out in affluent suburban communities are being educated to think and probe and question so that as adults they'll be capable of cultural capaciousness and political sagacity, the children of the poor are being trained in a culturally barren, abject servility. In Los Angeles, it's been an intense day. School called Fremont High School that holds 5,000 pupils. So crowded, they have to go right through the summer, and they get 20 less days of school per year than other children in California as a result of this peculiar year-round calendar. But half the kids in the school go to class in trailers. I visited a 10th grade history class. Teacher was wonderful. See, I meet terrific teachers everywhere I go. Now here, this happened to be a young teacher in Fremont High. She has 40 kids in her class. 40! And she has 6 classes every day, okay? Including homeroom. I say to her, how the hell do you teach 40 kids? She says, here, find out. And she hands me her class. They always do that to me. And so I taught her class of 40 kids for the last hour of the school day. And kids were so eloquent. They knew I was a writer. They wanted to pour their feelings out. At their request, we did a second hour. So I taught 40 kids for 2 hours. And one beautiful girl in that class, a Latina girl named Mariah, wanted to go to college. And her teacher said she was very bright and ought to go to college. Told me she'd been forced to take a sewing class the year before. Do they teach sewing in Oakland? I don't think. Goodness. So she said she had to take sewing the year before. And this year, she was told she had to take hairdressing. I don't want to suggest in any way that I disrespect any way of earning a living. All careers are honorable, but, you know, still, they don't insist on sewing and hairdressing at Beverly Hills High School. And they certainly didn't insist on that in the lovely suburban school that my sister attended. This is part of the apartheid curriculum in America. And I said, you get credit? You get academic credit for hairdressing? She says, yes. I said, what would you rather take? She said, well, I wanted to take AP English. But they only had a few AP English slots, and they had a lot of openings in hairdressing. And I guess I looked incredulous. I shouldn't be after all these years, you know, but another student in the class, an African-American student who was little, she looked like a sixth grader, but it was 10th grade, and a very sassy little girl. I really took a liking to her right away. She had these rectangular blue tinted glasses propped up on her forehead. Picture that. And I said, I'm really stunned that in this day and age, they still would channel kids of color into job training like that, instead of letting you take an academic course. And this little African-American girl says to me, Mister, we see in more than y'all can see. I said, have you taken hairdressing too? She said, oh yes, I took two courses in hairdressing. I said, you got credit for both? She said, yep, one was hairdressing and one was advanced hairdressing, like AP hairdressing. At that point, Mariah starts to cry in front of all the children, in front of all 40 kids, in front of me. She starts to cry. She says, I don't want to take hairdressing. I didn't need sewing either. I knew how to sew. My mother is a seamstress in a sewing factory. I'm trying to go to college. I don't need to sew to go to college. My mother sews. I hope for something more. At that point, this wonderful, thin, dark-eyed guy named Fortino, he has these dark eyes just loaded with a cynical intelligence. He looks right at her, and he says, listen, Mariah, the owners of the sewing factories need laborers, right? And then she says, I guess they do. And he says, they're not going to hire their own kids for those kinds of jobs, are they? Another student says, why not? And Mariah says, so they can grow beyond themselves, but we remain the same. This represents nothing less than a purposeful and conscious cognitive decapitation of potential in children of the black and brown and poor.
A disregard for a balanced education is only part of the horrible situation poor children face. Another factor is the physical environment around them. Kozel uses the lunchroom to compare youth studying and learning in crappy, overcrowded urban buildings to students who attend better-off suburban schools.
Then I go back to the suburban schools. I mean, I have to keep doing this, so I'll remember what money buys for the privileged in America. And I go back to a suburban school, and I see, you know, these lovely lunchrooms, with pleasant cafeteria lines. They have salad bars. It's like a college, you know. And pretty little hexagonal tables where the kids can sit together in nice weather. A lovely terrace where they can eat outside. Aesthetics, beauty, has a very important effect upon children. In these affluent communities, the loveliness of the surroundings refines the souls of the children. And in squalid, overcrowded, messy basement cafeterias where children of color are herded along for squalid feedings, the ugliness of the surroundings coarsens their spirits. This is one of the major ways in which it's never talked about in curriculum discussions, but you know, this is one of the granting of beauty or the denial of beauty is one of the most powerful ways by which we shape caste divisions in this nation.
Another problem poor students are forced to deal with is the No Child Left Behind Act, or NCLB. No Child Left Behind forces hundreds of schools across the country to maintain certain scores on high-stakes tests. Schools where students do not achieve adequate scores may lose funding, be forced to fire teachers, or lose students to other schools. These standards have led to a decline in courses like art, music, and PE. Instead, students must constantly prepare for their tests. Jonathan Kozel begins to address some of the issues surrounding No Child Left Behind and high-stakes testing.
President says testing is the answer. Testing is the answer to our problems. And as a result, in many urban schools I've been visiting, even though NCLB only requires the high-stakes test to start in third grade, many of the schools I visit are starting in first grade because they want to get the kids ready, right? There's one California district where they start high-stakes testing in the last 2 weeks of September of kindergarten year. Kindergarten! The end of September, welcome to school, children. You know, these little kids don't yet know that, they don't know that pages go from left to right. Some of them don't know how to hold a pencil. They pee in their pants. If at least we gave these kids an opportunity for pre-K education, I mean real good pre-K education, they might have a better chance to pass these tests in the early grades of school. But in most of the nation, this is simply not the case. And I don't care what the statistics claim, I'll tell you the truth. My beloved friend Marion Wright Edelman at the Children's Defense Fund. You know Marion, I'm sure. And Marion told me that under Mr. Bush, the percentage of low income, that is eligible preschoolers, children who get Head Start, has dropped to below 50%, less than half eligible children get even 1 year half-day pre-K. In the poorest districts I visit, to be honest, it's far lower than that. It's far less than that. You know how you really find out how many kids get real pre-K? You do not go to some database from, you know, some think tank. You ask the children. Ask the kindergarten kids, what did you do last year? That's how I do it. Or better, you ask the kids. Kids get mixed up. I ask the teacher. A kindergarten teacher knows, for sure. And typically she'll say to me in New York, for example, in the Bronx, where I spend a lot of time, she'll say, maybe a third of them got something for half a day for 1 year before they came to me. Sometimes they'll say scarcely a quarter, only a handful. Now, meanwhile, what do you think the children of privilege received during those years? Well, I know. And I know because I know rich people. I went to Harvard, and a lot of my classmates in New York, for example, are very wealthy. And I ask them, what do you do with your kids? And typically, they start their children in these terrific, rich, developmental pre-K programs at the age of 2 or 2.5. And they're full-day programs. They're usually 11-hour programs. And these are really something. These are not drill and grill academies, I can assure you. It's not the kind of thing Bush wants to do to Head Start. But these are marvelous places where children learn social skills and pre-literacy and numeracy skills, but in a healthy, comfortable way. You know, I mean, they don't take these poor little 2.5-year-olds and making them chant long O's and short A's. You know what they cost? In New York City, the top pre-K programs, these are private programs, cost $22,000 a year. The best ones are known as the Baby Ivies. Why do you think? Because it's assumed that this is the first step to, the top colleges in America. Meanwhile, the little ones that I write about are sitting at home, staring at the TV screen or looking up the window into the street. A couple of years later, in third grade, if not sooner, they take their high-stakes tests, which in many states now determine whether you can be promoted, usually determines whether you get into gifted and talented programs, right? First stage in tracking. You know, who does best on these tests? The little ones who have been in these beautiful pastel painted Montessori programs for 3 or 4 years, or the ones, you know, the ones who got nothing at all? I happen to think it's outrageous to impose so many high-stakes tests on children in the early grades of school if we have first denied them any opportunity for pre-K education. There's something deeply hypocritical in a society that holds a little girl, maybe 7 or 8 years old, accountable, right? Isn't that the buzzword now? Holds that little baby, 7-year-old, accountable for her performance on a standardized exam, but does not hold the president and the Congress accountable for robbing her of what they gave their own kids 6 years ago. These little vulnerable kids I write about, the ones who get virtually no pre-K education and then enter public school only to be humiliated and bludgeoned by exams, have done absolutely nothing wrong. They've committed no crimes. They're too small to harm us. They're too sweet to hate us. And they're far too innocent to fear us. Later, they will discover that this nation doesn't love them very much. And then they'll get tougher. But now they're innocent children. Their only sin, if such it is to be born poor and of the wrong color at a bitterly cold moment in our nation's history. Now, I want to make a few final comments about high-stakes testing. More than a few, actually. Because these tests are creating a state of terror in the schools I visit. Since NCLB went into effect, principals in many schools, but particularly the segregated schools, the ones that are under the sword because of alleged low performance, principals in these schools live in a state of continual anxiety. And they pass it right on to the teachers. Teachers in many inner-city schools, and I gather on the basis of what I heard before I came up to speak, happens in a lot of Oakland schools, are basically handed scripted curricula to read. Geared directly to the state standards. Often it's printed right in the margin. I see you nodding. You know? And in many systems, they call these scripted programs teacher-proof. You ever heard that? What a lovely way to welcome young teachers into this profession, right? You know, here's something where no matter how stupid you are, if you do it exactly the way somebody at McGraw-Hill or wherever says you must, you know, you can't fail. In New York, for a while, they were using an awful method called, with a very modest title, a scripted system called Success for All. Yeah. It's, to me, like a proto-fascist curriculum. In Success for All, to silence the children, you have to do this, you go like that. Teachers call it the Hitler salute. You know, you can't write on the blackboard outcome. Don't you have to do things like that? You can't write outcome or objective. I read an early lyrical poem of Langston Hughes or William Butler Yeats to my third graders, and I discovered that they loved it. A teacher has to say, I utilized this poem of William Butler Yeats to deliver the following 3 proficiencies that will be tested on exams. And she has to give a number for them. Do you have to do that in Oakland? She has to write a number on the blackboard. Like, you know, I used William Butler Yeats to deliver English language skill 27B. And then after that, it might, you know, be something like antonyms or whatever, you know. Now, that number is absolutely useless. I mean, I see these numbers everywhere I go in all the big city school systems. That number is useless. No kid is going to come back to you 30 years later and say, Miss O'Brien, I'm so grateful to you. My life just wouldn't have been the same if I hadn't learned ELA 27B. You know? That number just means it's of no value. It's only there to defend us against the Gestapo, you know, and they come around and check on us and see, have we done, you know, are we sufficiently servile to their wishes? They use a lot of business language in justifying these curricula. They often don't call children children. They refer to the child as the product. Yes. Have you ever seen that? Yes. The child is the product of the school. And with the value added of requisite proficiency. As if these children didn't have inherent value in the first place. And so they never look for the secret in that child's soul. No, they're going to impose something from outside. And typically, it's mercantile. It's something that has to do with production. Oh, in Ohio, two schools I visited there, starting in kindergarten, on the wall, it said, the mission of our school is to produce workers who will sharpen our competitive edge in the global market. And I thought, you know, this was in kindergarten. So, what the hell should a kindergarten kid care about the global market? You know, she cares, a little kindergarten baby cares about belly buttons or itchy elbows, you know.
This is People's Tribune Radio. Teacher Jonathan Kozel is speaking at an event for public school teachers in Oakland, California. Kozel now speaks about how disastrous education has become for poor children. He even identifies the political risks needed to transform the current structure of education.
The injuries inflicted on white suburban children are not even in the same ballpark as the havoc, the catastrophic damage that is being done to children in the Lazaretto districts that have largely been abandoned by white people. And anyone who tries to blur the difference is, to me, an enemy of the poor children in this country. This started in the counterculture years ago when people who were politically gutsy, people who started out marching in places like Greensboro and Selma in the South, and who went down to fight in the freedom movement in Mississippi, people who started out fighting for the rock bottom poor ended up fighting for Weecher in Vermont. And the point is, you know, with all respect to counterculture, and I know I'm in the heart of it here in the Bay Area, they ended up starting these sort of euphoric free schools out in the country, which were as white and upscale as anything you would have seen in the white Christian academies of the South 50 years before. I insist there's a big difference. Yes, it's damaging to all children to be exposed to any type of corporate indoctrination or to any of what Paolo calls the banking approach to education. Yes, it limits the ethical potential of almost any human being to be bludgeoned by an oppressive curriculum. But there's a tremendous difference between being oppressed emotionally and psychologically by some of the pressures that you see in rich suburban schools, but at the same time having a lot of parents in that community, including your own usually, who grew up in the years of struggle and can infuse your life with a great deal of that ethical longing to counteract the NCLB and so forth. Most of those suburban school systems, no matter what you or Alfie Cohn might think, thumb their nose at an awful lot of what is coming down from Washington. I know it because I visit those schools constantly. I don't think we should just read each other's books. We got to go back to those schools, not on official visits. You got to go back the way I do, where you can just slip in and visit any class in the building. And I'm telling you, most of those really good schools, ironically, the schools attended by the children of the surgeons and lawyers and CEOs, still are filled with classrooms in which they do stuff that's profoundly subversive of everything that Mr. Bush intends. I'm telling you. And the schools under siege in the inner city, where they're so-called low-performing, where they haven't met their AYPs, their benchmarks, goddamn rubrics and everything, that with teachers, where principals actually are asking to retire early because they're getting chest pains, and where they pass this on to the teachers. This is where we see what I call cognitive decapitation. It's a total obliteration of the possibilities for these young people. And even if they pump the scores in fourth grade, it doesn't do any good because they're temporary gains due to drilling for the tests. And 4 years later in eighth grade, you meet the same kids and they cannot write a cogent sentence or ask a probing question. How do you defy this? You're gonna have to take some big political risks, because the forces against you is not just something in California. This is a national thing. They only want poor kids to be trained in things that are immediately of utilitarian value to the economy, and they mean the lower levels of the economy. So testing them in the math and literacy skills that they, I mean, drilling them in those things, because they're tested and because they have a direct correlation to future employability, is all that they care about. There's nothing in NCLB about beauty. There's nothing in there about happiness. You're going to have to fight it politically. This is not just a local California problem. The locking art and music out many districts. Listen, it's worse. In Atlanta, they canceled recess for all children to have 20 minutes more to drill them for the tests. I think we need large, highly visible, symbolic actions, in whether they're protest marches or whether they're dramatic court cases or legislation, to electrify the spirits of young people with possibilities. One example, the day I began this book tour, I stopped off to do a TV interview on air with a congressman from Chicago, Jesse Jackson Jr., Reverend Jackson's son. He's a brilliant young guy, and he has introduced an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that establishes a high level of equal education as a fundamental right of all children in America. A lot of people don't realize that under the Constitution, especially because of those of you who studied school finance, because of the terrible decision of the Nixon court in a case called Rodriguez, that the U.S. Constitution offers absolutely no protection to children when it comes to equal education. The 14th Amendment does not apply. And most Americans, if you tell them that, they say, really? It should protect them. Most people are startled by that. Is it, you mean to say our children depend for their ultimate entitlement to education on some school board in Omaha or on some nutcake governor in California? But they don't fly the flag of California in their schools. They swear a pledge of allegiance to the United States. They should be protected by their government. But they're not. We have to keep holding out to young people concrete possibilities for things to demand.
It takes all of us to make use of the demands for quality education. Teachers, students, parents, even administrators can no longer stand by and watch public education dissipate into a world of privatization and free market politics. Today, we must gain control of the demands we want for our children's education. That is it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Every month, PT Radio, in association with the newspaper People's Tribune, the bilingual magazine Tribuno del Pueblo, and Speakers for a New America, attempts to share with you information and visions for a cooperative society. To find out more information, please call us at 1-800-691-6888. Once again, 800-691-6888. Or you can just visit us on the web at www.ptradio.org. I'm Kenny Shook. Thanks for listening, and please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.